You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. This is News Team correspondent Emma Hutchins, and today I'm joined in the studio by organizers with the Steady Collective. Welcome.
My name is Laura Eshelman, and I've been a board member of the Steady Collective since October of 2016.
I'm Hillary Brown. I'm an outreach worker staff person with the Steady Collective.
I'm Michel Guichenet. I'm a peer support specialist, outreach worker, and survivor of Hep C and liver transplant.
Thank you all so much for coming today. So tell us about the work of the Steady Collective.
Sure. So the Steady Collective has been around for a little over a year, and we started as a harm reduction support group. Any positive change was sort of the model there, and then we moved into naloxone distribution. Naloxone is an overdose reversal drug for opioids. And then when needle exchange was legalized in the state of North Carolina, that's been in the last year, we started also doing needle exchange.
For our listeners who have never heard of needle exchange, how does it work?
Sure. So we do two outreach days a week. One of those days is in the back of Firestorm Books on Tuesdays, and the other day is at Haywood Street Congregation, where our office is, and that's on Wednesdays. And both of those days, we hand out naloxone to drug users because we believe that drug users are the real first responders to overdoses. And then we also hand out clean syringes and clean injecting equipment during that time. And clean injecting equipment, including needles, prevents the spread of Hep C and HIV, which are major problems in Western North Carolina. We also talk to folks about harm reduction tips in terms of safer injecting and how to use safely. And we also speak with folks about treatment options if that's something they want to do.
Your organization uses the frame of harm reduction. Can you tell us more about what that means and how it's different from other approaches to doing this kind of work?
Harm reduction, the way we do it, it's really on the front lines of what's happening. We talk to a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness, and the conditions where they live and what they have to go through every day is absolutely amazing. It's mind-boggling. Thankfully, there are people who come at the needle exchange that are also functional. They have jobs. They are all ages. And what is different is we don't have anything to sell. If, here are clean rigs so you don't get infected in any way. And if you want to stop or diminish whatever the case is, we can talk about it. We have several free recovery programs that I know because I've worked these three programs.
Yeah, I think something that stands out about harm reduction, whether we're talking about drug addiction or sex work or any high-risk behavior, what differentiates it from mainstream approaches and attitudes is it takes the moral judgment away from the behavior. Harm reduction rests on the premise that we live in a very complicated society and people will use drugs or engage in other behaviors for any number of reasons. They're going to do that. And so far, as we've seen in the past 40 years, prohibition, longer than 40 years, prohibition just hasn't worked. It's failed. So with that in mind, rather than castigating or shunning people for using needles, for using drugs, harm reduction teaches people and allows for people to engage in that behavior in the safest ways possible, whether that involves syringe exchange, overdose prevention with naloxone, passing out condoms, or even safer use techniques for injection or for smoking certain drugs, just tips on how to use. It takes away that moral judgment, and it allows us to build relationships with the people that are engaging in those behaviors so that there's trust and that there's a compassionate, outlet that that people know that they can turn to if they need help, whether that looks like treatment or simply just controlling and, monitoring use.
So it sounds like you're saving lives.
How many overdose reversals have we had this year alone?
Since January, from January to June, we've had 124 reported reversals. And sort of the way our reversal reporting works is that we hand out kits and then for free. And when folks come back to us, we ask, have you used any kits since the last time we saw you? And then we count those reversal reports and get a lot of details about what the reversals are looking like. And right now what we're hearing a lot of is that folks are having to use multiple vials or multiple kits of naloxone because of the presence of fentanyl. And Western North Carolina has a major issue with fentanyl. And we're hearing about that, you know, in Western Massachusetts or in Pennsylvania, but it's certainly a problem here. We definitely are collecting numbers and sort of looking at those and seeing things that, you know, are disturbing in terms of just the overdose rate is really high. And, you know, we also have parents come in who are getting naloxone because they, you know, have an adult child in the home who has just gotten out of rehab or just gotten back from jail. And they're really concerned that that person might overdose. And that's a reality that a lot of folks are living with here. I think that the opioid crisis is really touching, you know, everybody at this point.
And overdose, the reversals that we've heard about is probably our most measurable outcome. But with the presence of syringe exchange, we're not necessarily going to know how many people are avoiding hep C infection or HIV infection or how many abscesses or infections of other kinds are avoided. But when we talk about saving lives in the short term, overdose reversals are one thing that we can look at. But we're never going to know long term what the cost of healthcare savings is for an individual that was able to access a clean syringe or gauze or any other materials that make that practice safer.
Are there factors that you see or that you can point to that you would say are increasing the amount of opioid usage in this area?
Well, what we see through the folks that we serve at the outreach tables, we build one-on-one relationship. We get to know each other, so the stigma is, you know, out of the picture, and they tell us what's up there. So it varies. For the past few months, we had a lot of fentanyl put in heroin or pure fentanyl, another thing called gray death. So what we see is how the drugs change, same people, but the drug change. And for the last 2 weeks, it has been meth. Meth is everywhere, and that creates a lot of issues. But thankfully, we, by building this one-on-one relationship, we are able to have people going in the camps and handing out clean syringes to their peers.
And I think one of the things that we're seeing in terms of contributing to the elevation in use here is certainly, you know, we see a lot of factors converging. We're, you know, dealing with a lot of economic depression, and that's a major issue, is that folks are not able to get work and are feeling down about that. It's already been well documented that a lot of folks begin using opioids as painkillers after they have a major injury or an on-the-job injury, and then become dependent on that. And that is not, you know, we don't believe addiction is a moral issue anyway, but certainly becoming dependent on opioids is incredibly easy. Any of us could take opioids for a couple of weeks and would be dependent. Addiction and dependency are different. And so, you know, looking at this and knowing that folks are prescribed opioids and then become dependent and then can't get access to their prescription anymore and then begin using heroin, which is also an opiate, that a lot of that's happening. But, you know, I never want to undercut the fact that there are other social issues that are leading to this. And I do think that that is economic depression. We live in an area where industry has very much been gutted. You know, we used to have a lot of folks working in jobs where they made more money and jobs that were dependable. And now we have a lot of folks working sort of seasonally or, you know, not having consistent income. Also, elevating cost of housing is very difficult. And Asheville is particularly dealing with that. And it's really hard to lose your house and your job and be in a place that is rapidly changing. And so, you know, how do you deal with that when there's no funding for mental health care? That's another factor. So there are just many issues, and we have to be realistic about, like, some underlying cultural stuff that's leading to elevated drug use.
What we have noticed is that there's a lot of desperation, no hope. Folks play Russian roulette every day, six times a day. And That's what's happening.
I don't think that criminalization and stigma can be understated also in the reason that this has become such a big problem, namely because you know, people feel like they have to hide their addictions. They're worried about law enforcement. They're worried about legal repercussions. So they're not seeking help. And that also leads to a proliferation of misinformation about the opioid epidemic, about what these drugs do. And that's not just specific to Asheville. That's everywhere. That is a natural byproduct of prohibition. And it's something that we also are actively trying to change as much as we can with our capacity.
How do you see this being addressed at the state and local levels?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, most states are recognizing that they have an issue. This is a national problem, and so all states are grappling with it in different ways. I think that, you know, the county is now allocating money specifically to deal with the issue of opioids. There is a state plan for the opioid crisis and how that's going to be confronted. I think that folks are thinking about it and talking about it and making plans, but we're not seeing a ton of action yet. And, you know, it's hopeful that the conversation is happening. I look forward to government bodies realizing the value of harm reduction and funding it. A lot of times folks end up funding either more law enforcement or funding abstinence-only sort of approaches to recovery and care. And those have been proven to not be the most effective forms of care. So I look forward to harm reduction being funded, and we're here and already on the ground and doing work. And there's another needle exchange in town called the Needle Exchange Project of Asheville, and they've been doing great work for many years. And WinCap does great work with folks in terms of testing and supporting people and doing their own harm reduction. And so, you know, we hope that those things receive money as this moves forward, because we're going to need to do a lot of harm reduction work if we're going to stop not only the spread of disease, but I think it's important to note that folks can't go to recovery programs or treatment if they're dead, right? And so overdose prevention programs and programs that prevent disease are really making it possible for folks to one day go to treatment if that's the good fit for them.
What could harm reduction look like in a perfect world? What could that look like here in Asheville?
Well, in a perfect world, we would have injection rooms with a nurse supervising, where people can come, inject whatever they have to inject, and can do that safely and walk out with no problems. So that would take a lot of work with the police, right? We have a few issues with that. We're working on it. My vision, it's me, would be to have Asheville being such a cool town, so being a spearheading harm reduction and giving all the needs that we would have, several locations, not arresting people for a needle possession, that kind of stuff. We are working on that too.
Yeah, I think, you know, Michelle speaking to safe injection sites, that's huge. And I think, yeah, fully funding harm reduction and believing that it's not a side project, it's core, it's vital. And I think also just reframing internally a lot of departments and the way they think about things, you know, not saying that, you know, law enforcement and criminalization is the first answer to these things. I think also, you know, making medication-assisted treatment readily available to folks and not making folks have to jump through a million hoops to get Suboxone and buprenorphine and methadone. I think also, you know, prioritizing medical care and making it accessible to people. If people need to walk in and get care, people need mental health care, making that readily available and not hugely expensive. So I think all of those things. And I also think, you know, treatment on demand is a huge issue. There aren't enough beds in the facilities that exist. And we need, when folks show up at the table and say, I'm tired of using, I want to go to detox, I want to go to treatment, for us to be able to go, we have a place today and it's going to be good. And you're going to leave and you're going to feel better. And that is not something we get to say a lot. And so I think those things, and I do think reducing stigma or eliminating stigma about drug use. So many folks in our culture use drugs, and most of that's legal. So, you know, thinking differently about what it requires to live in this complicated world, and giving folks a break.
You know, there's different faces of harm reduction all around the world, and they're all fascinating and kind of beautiful in their own way. And I'd love to see little pieces of that, you know, coming to Asheville. Supervised injection sites have already been mentioned. There's a place in Vancouver called Insight that's been operating for, I think, a decade now. And they haven't seen a fatal overdose yet. So to have something like that in Asheville would be beautiful. But even in lieu of that, if we had a mobile unit with nurses, with healthcare workers that could go to the places where people are using and be able to provide a similar service, then that's, you know, that's another alternative. I mean, these things happen and they work. As you probably know, Oregon just decriminalized all drugs. That's not the same as legalization. That's decriminalization, similar to what Portugal has, where if you are caught in possession of an illegal drug, it's not a criminal citation. You are required to go get an evaluation, a health evaluation, but it is framed as a public health concern. So at the state level or at the local level, I believe something like that could be done, and that would cause fewer people to go, you know, into hiding. So those are a couple of examples, I think, of what harm reduction in Asheville could look like. I do think it's going to take a while to get there, though, because overcoming traditional attitudes about drugs, drug use, and what that actually means is probably the biggest hurdle that we have to get over.
We're coming up on Overdose Awareness Day on August 31st. Can you talk about the significance of that?
So I think the significance of Overdose Awareness Day, it's more significant than ever. And I think that local folks in the local area, you know, we hear so often from people who are coming in and not only talking about their fear, their incredible fear about overdosing, having something cut into their dose that they did not know was there, but also reporting the reversals that they've done. So we have really traumatized folks coming in and saying, you know, I used 4 kits on somebody last night. And yeah, they came back around, but when will it happen again? You know, and this is, you know, I want to be really clear that what's happening is people aren't just being wild and reckless. The presence of fentanyl makes everything a guessing game. We have folks who have been long-term heroin users and have been safe and fine and have never overdosed, all of a sudden overdosing, because the dose they've used for 12 years suddenly has fentanyl in it, and it makes it much stronger. Fentanyl is about 100 times stronger than morphine. So it's unpredictable. And I think that there are more and more people who've had a sibling or a child or a parent die. And, you know, this is a time to really say, like, we support those folks, and we're going to think really creatively about how to offer care to people who've been using drugs. This is a really marginalized community, and this is a justice issue. Drug use is right now inherently criminal here. And so, you know, folks are scared. They're being hurt. They can't go anywhere for care. They overdose and they reverse at home. They don't call EMS because EMS brings the police. They're scared to go to the hospital because they're afraid they'll be pulled over on the way and charged with possession. Like, it's just gotten to a really tough spot. And I think Overdose Awareness Day should bring all that into focus for us.
Officially, there are 24 million Americans with a substance use disorder. So that means that each family has somebody who has a substance use disorder. So it's not us and them. There's no more of that. It's, you know, one block and everybody's concerned.
The fact that the opioid epidemic and addiction are so prevalent in headlines today is another reason why Overdose Awareness Day this year is a particularly important event. We come from the mindset that the vast majority of overdose deaths are preventable. And right now we're up against some really high stakes because the cost of naloxone is increasing. Now that a state of emergency has been declared, that does allow the Department of Health and Human Services to negotiate with the manufacturers of Narcan, but we haven't heard anything yet. And with the cost of Narcan rising, that makes our work even more difficult. So while it's a chance to come together and to honor the lives that have been lost, I think it's also a chance for us to discuss what we need to do in the face of challenges like that. As Hillary mentioned, we do have Good Samaritan laws in North Carolina. It was passed in 2013, where people can call 911, and they are not liable for prosecution for small amounts of drugs or paraphernalia. The problem is that law enforcement is usually the first to show up, and they also don't carry naloxone. So with that in mind, with the systemic challenges that we're facing, how do we at a grassroots level also overcome those challenges? How do we build those relationships so that we don't have to rely on institutions to save these lives?
So can you tell our listeners about the different ways that they can access the resources that you provide in the community and where they can learn more information?
Sure. So folks can always go to thestudycollective.org, which is our website. Folks can also go to our Facebook or our Twitter, which are updated pretty regularly. We have two outreach days, as I mentioned. Tuesday is 1:30 to 4 in the back of Firestorm. And we table there and do full harm reduction services there. And then we also distribute at Haywood Congregation on Wednesdays from 10 to 3. And that overlaps with their meal there. And so we have those two options. And we also have regular volunteer trainings. And we welcome folks to go to our website and fill out a volunteer application, go through our training. We always need a lot of help. Michelle and I are the only two staff people. We're both part-time. So those are always options for folks to plug in. I think also, you know, just having conversations with people about the importance of harm reduction and doing some personal education on what this crisis looks like is really work that needs to happen on an individual level. So I'd encourage folks to do that.
Again, it's a we problem. People they can't count on anybody else to take care of the problem. Like, oh, yeah, they're going to take care of it. No. We have to take care of it. Knowing how to administer naloxone should be like CPR. A lot of people should know how to do that, because overdoses are happening everywhere. Supermarket, parking lot, church. So, yeah. There's a lot of education to do with that.
Yeah, I think my final thought would just be that the folks who are using drugs in our community are in a lot of pain and experiencing a lot of grief from losing friends. And folks need a lot of help right now. And I really would encourage mental health care providers to step out and figure out ways to stand with folks who are using drugs and to support them. And I really want to encourage people to think about this as a justice issue, that providing care and making treatment more available and releasing funds is about doing what's just on behalf of drug users.
Even though the opioid epidemic has certainly reached pretty large proportions in recent years, drug use is by no means a recent problem. It's simply that we have relegated people with addictions and people who use drugs to the margins of society. So we haven't been able to see what it really looks like until today. And, you know, that's in large part because there have been there's been an increase in deaths in the middle class white community. That aside, I think that now is a prime opportunity to start humanizing drug users. They're not just drug users. They are people who use drugs. They use them for any number of reasons, and it should be seen as a health problem, and as Hillary said, it is a justice issue. And with that in mind, if we can start, you know, viewing people who make choices, whatever those choices might be and whether we agree with them or not, as people, then we can start to proceed with practical and and justice-oriented solutions.
Well, thank you all so much for coming in to talk with us and give us a snapshot into what this work looks like and what the future could look like, what some options are. Thanks for the work that you do.